Welcome to Sound Practice, the business podcast for physicians and healthcare leaders, hosted by Mike Tsakopoulos and produced by the American Association for Physician Leadership.
When I asked the young lady working at my local coffee shop, "How's it going?" she responded, "Today's been brutal. We've been hit on all fronts. Today makes Antietam pale in comparison." My disaffected barista aside, many people make hyperbolic statements comparing events in their life to war. In truth, few people's days are filled with life or death decisions. Healthcare workers and members of our armed forces are in that small minority. My guest today has leadership experience in both healthcare and the United States Army. His time commanding troops in combat has informed his leadership skills. Prepare to hear from an absolute American and leader. Next on Sound Practice. My guest today is Lieutenant General Mark Hertling. Prior to his retirement in 2013, General Hertling was commander of the United States Army Forces in Europe. He commanded the 1st Armored Division and Task Force Iron in northern Iraq during the surge. Post-retirement from the United States Army, General Hertling has served as a senior vice president with Advent Health, an analyst for CNN, and a member of the Dean's Advisory Board at Indiana University's School of Public Health. He is author of Growing Physician Leaders and the recently released If I Don't Return, A Father's Wartime Journal. Lieutenant General Mark Hertling, welcome to Sound Practice.
Well, it is great to be with you, and I'm excited about this conversation because as I normally do, as you know, is make national security comments, but I'm in love with the healthcare industry and the people who work as professionals in healthcare. So it's fun to talk a little bit about leadership in healthcare for a change.
Well, good. We are absolutely thrilled that you're here today. And General, you just started to allude to something that's my first question. It's not entirely obvious to me how you became interested in healthcare. Can you explain?
It's not obvious to me either, except for the fact, I'll give a little bit of my background. The Army sent me, as you know, to the Indiana University School of Public Health to get a master's degree in kinesiology so I could teach at West Point. So that was my first dunking into the human body and the things associated with it. I've always been interested in fitness and physical activity. Spent some of my career doing some things, served on the President's Council on Fitness. But when I was retiring, I was approached by the chief operating officer of Advent Health, which is the largest nonprofit healthcare system in the country, and a very good one, by the way, and asked me if I wanted to come work for him. And my response to that was, you know, I'm not a doctor, right? I'm a tanker, because I was about to be retired from the Army. And he laughed and he said, yeah. He said, what we're trying to do is establish a new initiative at Advent Health called global partnering. What they wanted to do is look all over the world for unique ways to solve medical issues. And he said, we know how to do that, but we don't know how to invade other countries. So we were told by Walt Disney, a senior vice president at Disney, to hire a retired general to help us with this program. So I was intrigued by that. And then when I went to Advent Health here in Orlando, I was just fascinated by their values, by the quality of their organization, and I signed on with them. So I worked for them for close to 10 years. And while I was working this global partnering initiative, my office was right next door to the chief medical officer, who is a great guy, a guy named Dr. Dave Moorhead. And he didn't know anything about the Army. So every once in a while, he would come into me and ask me questions about leadership and how we would do certain things in the Army, because he was experiencing an issue with a physician. And after a couple of months, he said, you know, we've tried to establish a physician leadership program here, and we've contracted out to universities and different organizations. He said, now we've got a leadership expert right here amongst our midst. So why don't you try and put together a leadership program for us? So I did a little bit more cultural research within the healthcare community and working with the doctors there. We did our very first leadership course in 2014. And what we saw just teaching the elements of leadership, and I was the instructor to a group of 50 that included, normally we had a split of 35 doctors, 10 nurses, and 5 administrators from the different hospitals, teaching that team approach and self-analysis and how you contribute to an organization, no matter what the organization is, started to really institute a cultural change within the organization. So Advent Health really liked what we were doing. They expanded the program. I started teaching more classes. And by the end of the time I was serving with Advent Health, we had probably graduated close to 1,000 doctors, nurses, and administrators who were running the system by that point. And part of the rationale on that was the chief operating officer said, you know, we always wanted to get physicians at the table. They were not involved in the decision-making of the business environment. And that struck me, having come out of the military, because we try and get a lot of people at the table to determine how we conduct operations. That's why we had the doctors, nurses, and administrators in the classes. And what I'll tell you, I learned later, studying this more, that is what the American Medical Association calls interprofessional education, which not many people do. They either have all doctors in a course or all nurses in a course or all business executives in a course, and they don't talk to each other, even though they're of different cultures. So that's what started it all. And since then, I've done a doctoral research study on physician leadership here at one of the local universities, Rollins College and the Crummer School of Business, where I now teach, and really dug into physician leadership specifically. That's a long answer, and I'm sorry I took so long explaining it all.
I'm not sorry at all. That was a great answer. Thank you. So I'm interested, as you transition from a military background into healthcare, as you just described, what surprised you most about that move? And what did you find maybe oddly familiar?
Well, what's interesting, when you start talking about leadership writ large, it all follows a specific pattern. There are four elements, the research says, to leadership. You have to have a leader with attributes and competencies. You have to influence other people, and you do it in context. And that's the simplest way to explain it. In the military, we teach leadership at every single level. It is part of our school system. It's in the schoolhouses. We do drills outside of the schoolhouse when we're in operational environments. And what I saw different between the military and medicine is that we really focus on developing leaders. The medical community does not. And, the other thing Dr. Moorhead told me when we first started developing this program is he said, when I told him how we did it, he said, you know, that's interesting because you seem to spend a lot of time developing leaders. In healthcare, we try and during med school almost to beat leadership out of people and teach them science. So it's a combination of the science and art of both professions, both the military and medicine. The other thing that I found unique and which really applied was when you take a look at the professional requirements of any organization like medicine or the legal profession or the ministry or the military, professionals have certain things they have to do, different from normal businessmen. And what I saw was that soldiers and doctors are a lot alike. And that might sound strange, but as I engage with physicians and nurses, you know, they are 100% dedicated to their profession. When they introduce themselves, they don't say, hey, I work at Advent Health. They say, I'm a doctor. Well, I always said when I was a soldier, you know, I didn't say, well, I did these assignments. It's I was a soldier. The other important thing is medicine and the military are the only two professions that deal in life and death. So their success is critical. We have to save our soldiers while killing the enemy. Doctors, physicians have to save people and really commit to their care and the capability of providing that do no harm. So there's a dynamic there that I think is interrelated, and which really shows how important leadership is. The art and science of leadership is important to each profession.
Is leadership, do you think, different in situations of life and death than it may be in corporate America?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And I think that's a key difference. Getting to meet literally hundreds and perhaps even thousands of doctors, there's a kindred spirit. And the other thing that's interesting about that is, like medicine, the Army has cults. I'm a tanker. We compete with infantry and artillery and aviation people. Doctors have different cults too. You have the surgeons and the family practitioners and the urologist and the ED department heads, and they all approach their jobs in very different ways too, with all the same intent on combining. In the Army, we combine all those cults to defend the nation. In healthcare, all those cults are combined to provide care for the patients and their families.
It strikes me that the training in the military and in the medical profession for specialization takes a long time and is relatively similar. So that may provide an opportunity for commonality and collegiality, for a better word. Does that offer unique opportunities for leaders in those both fields?
I think so, because you're sharing different approaches. One of the things, if you look at leadership theory and the different theories that are out there, and there are literally dozens of them in the research element, a physician really is, if he or she is a pure physician, they are focused on servant leadership. They exist primarily to serve the patient. Now, servant leaders aren't supposed to be concerned about money at all, but of course, doctors and nurses want to be paid, but they're really out for a pure reason of serving other people. Whereas businessmen, for the most part, they may say they're servant leaders, but they're really interested in making the organization profitable. I mean, that's the element of business. You have to provide a product and make money doing it. Nurses are sort of in the middle. They have the servant leadership style, but they also know that they have to be transformational, under transformational leadership theory of continuing to build the organization. So when you have, I hate to use the word industry, but when you are talking about the healthcare industry, you have these very different approaches coming together to do the best they possibly can for the people they serve. It was interesting at Advent Health, and I'm sure this is the same case with other healthcare systems. They say they have to do good. I'm sorry, they have to do well to do good. And what they mean by that is they have to make a buck in order to serve the community. If a physician is completely pure, they don't care about making that buck. Of course they do, but they really are all involved with what their profession requires, the do no harm and the situation with values and ethos within the medical profession.
You're writing for the Physician Leadership Journal, compared physicians trained in an all physician cohort versus interprofessional cohort with nurses, physicians, administrators. And you spoke a little bit about that earlier. Can you walk us through what you expected to find and where results surprised you when you got into that?
I am so happy that you asked that question, because that was something that I wanted to do when I began this doctoral program. And I won't tell you the whole long story of how I got into a doctoral program at 63 years old, but I am proud of the fact that I was the oldest student and the oldest of all the professors that taught me. And it brought a whole lot of life experience to it from the military. But the reason for getting in that is because of an argument I had with the chief of human resources at Advent Health. And what she told me was we needed to separate the doctors from the nurses and the administrators in different programs. And that struck me as bizarre, because if you're trying to build teams that understand each other and that are all trying to reach the same objectives, you have to have that cross-functional communication. Even though they may see things differently, and certainly they do, it's interesting to me as I started going into my doctoral research, how many research papers were dedicated to proving how doctors and nurses are always in conflict and how doctors and administrators are always in conflict. And so, you know, it became patently obvious to me that you have to pull them all together to have those hard conversations, just like we do in the military between combat arms people and logisticians and intelligence officers. If you're not talking to each other, you don't understand how to solve the problems. So that was the basis for the research. And what I did was go outside of Advent Health to hospitals I didn't know, one hospital in Chicago and one in Chattanooga. And I took two different groups of classes. One group was all doctors, physicians from different specialties. The other one was the mix. And my hypothesis was that both of them would improve in the things we were measuring, but that the mixed group would improve even greater because they had that cross communication. And that turned out to be true. Both groups improved in terms of the leadership skills we were measuring, things like team building, communication, partnership on crisis management, and others that are part of the research study. But the mixed group, because they were cross-talking more, improved at a greater significance, P greater than 0.01 in almost every subject. What was also surprising, two things came out of this that was surprising. One, what we did is we asked each person in the course to give us an observer who would report after this 6-month-long course on what they had seen. So each person had that we collected data from had a peer physician, a peer nurse, an administrator who supervised them, and their spouse or partner, who were also commenting on what they had seen in terms of changes. Across the board, everyone reported changes, positive changes. The doctors themselves, in self-observing, they also said that they were different. They had more courage to speak up. They felt themselves able to assume leadership roles. But not a surprise was that the nurses across the board were the ones that were way off the chart. What was a surprise was how many spouses and partners were also off the chart, that they had seen changes in the home life in terms of communication and empathy and those kind of things from their physician mate, which was interesting. One other thing came out of the study. The hospital in Chicago, the CMO there, as I showed him what we were going to be measuring in these pre and post course surveys, he said, "Hey, we've been having a little bit of challenge with burnout from physician." He said, "Could you include a question on burnout pre and post?" And of course, like all doctoral students, I went, "Oh my gosh, another thing to add to my study." But because they were paying me to do this as part of the research, I said, "Sure, I can do that." Well, what we also found, never mentioning the word burnout or resiliency anywhere through the course, that in both courses, the all doctor course and the mixed course, there was vast improvement in resilience and lesser feelings of burnout between all the participants. And truthfully, I don't know why that is. My thesis advisor suggested it was because they had a better sense of purpose after attending the leadership course, and they felt like they were more part of the organization, which we can talk about too if you want, because we've since done a couple other research studies on that.
This strikes me as being all the more important today, because at the beginning of our careers, most physicians were either self-employed or worked for organizations that were wholly owned and controlled by physicians. But that's untrue today, right?
Right.
The vast majority, or at least a significant majority of physicians, work for an organization that is that they don't have any ownership interest in. They are employees.
Well, if I can comment on that, because that's in the first chapter of my first book on growing physician leaders, I talk about how there are close to 6,000 hospitals or 6,000 systems in the United States, hospital system, healthcare systems, and only about 300 of them, a little less than 300 of them, are run by physicians. So you can see how the businessmen and women of the nation have kind of taken over healthcare. And if they're not cooperating and coordinating with their physician leaders, they may have some challenges in terms of how they do business.
The military's be, no, do leadership model forms the backbone of your physician leadership framework. How did you translate from battlefield to bedside with that?
Well, it was relatively easy, to be honest. The be part of the be, no, do is really about what is your character and how do you present yourself? What's your, what we call in the business community, executive presence, or rather, I just like to call it presence, of the combination of who you are versus how other people see you and how you have to bring the two of those things together. The intellect piece really doesn't focus on the skills of a physician because I wouldn't be bold enough to make any comment on that. But it focuses on intellectual intelligence, emotional intelligence, the way you see the world, your caring and empathy, your humility, all of those things become important in the no part. And then the do part of the be no do equation is really, how do you communicate? How do you influence other people? How do you build your team and develop your subordinates, not only your physician subordinates, but other members of your team? And how do they contribute to you as a leader? How do they provide you feedback? And then really, how do you focus on also influencing your bosses? I can't tell you the number of conversations I've had with doctors who have asked me, hey, I got to get the CEO to do this program. How do I influence them to buy me more robots for my robotic surgery? Or how do I get funding for some type of call schedule? Those kind of things. And it's really influencing your bosses the same way you would influence the people who work for you, understanding their motivations and realizing how you can make your problem their issue and how they can help you take on solving the problems that you see as a physician. So those are the kinds of things we teach in the be no do model in the military that creates, you know, collaborative organizations that coordinate with one another.
Let's shift gears. I'd like to discuss your new book, If I Don't Return, A Father's Wartime Journal, which has, as of the airing of this podcast, just been released. Why did you write the book?
I was forced to do it by our youngest son, to be honest with you. So the story behind this book, if I can elaborate a little bit, was during Desert Storm in 1991, I was part of a unit that was told before the war, before we deployed, that we were going to be leading the 1st Armored Division. I was in a cavalry squadron, which does reconnaissance. And the indicators by the intelligence community was there was the possibility that we would have, we would sustain 50% casualties. So when you're in a situation as a young person, and I was 30 at the time, where you're told that it's going to be a coin flip whether you return or not, you have some deep thoughts about what you want to leave behind in terms of your children and your family. So I started writing a daily journal during deployment, during the war, and after the war. We were there in Iraq for about 8 months. And in the early part of that journal, it was just advice to our two young sons, an 8-year-old and a 10-year-old, about how to grow up. You know, things about just values, friendship, love, the kinds of things you would want your young sons to know when they grow older if you're not around to teach them. So every day I would write a short journal entry, about a page long, and tuck it away on some either bizarre or deep subject. And then when the war started, I did the same thing after the war was over, after we were done with the 4-day attack into Iraq, talking about what we had experienced and what we had done during the war. So that's section two. And then section three is all about post-war things like post-traumatic stress, dealing with the enemy, dealing with the citizens, the civilians that were there. So this was a book, a journal written in hand. When I came home, here's the spoiler alert, I did survive. So I came home and our sons were still 8 and 10 and they had no interest in reading this deep journal that I had written. So I threw it in a footlocker and it stayed there for about 30 years. So a couple of years ago, 3 years ago, our youngest son asked my wife, hey, where's Dad's journal from Desert Storm? Because he was a soldier. He's now working in government and he just wanted to read it. And what he did is type it up and he inserted pictures for me. And on Christmas Day of 2024, when all the other kids, when our grandchildren had opened their presents and they were all busy, he came up to me and presented me with this typewritten document. And it was the first time I had opened it since 1991, and it brought back a flash of memories. And what Scott then said to me was, Dad, my brother and I realized why you were doing this. You were trying to prepare us in case you didn't come home. But since then, you've had a lifetime of experiences. So why don't you take this journal and expand on it? And I don't think he thought I would do it, to be honest with you. So I wanted to prove him wrong. And I immediately started writing in it. And it presented me an outline because I took each of the subjects that I had written about in 1991 and elaborated on all of them in terms of what I had learned more about morals and values and friendship and those kind of things that are still prevalent but have grown in terms of depth. But I also talked about the changes in the Army. And I also talked about what I had learned more regarding leadership and family values. So my publisher told me that he didn't think it was a military book. He thought it was more of a leadership book and a family book. And then the war came third. But one of the reasons I wanted to write it and publish it was because after serving as a military analyst on CNN for 10 years, which I did, I came to realize that because we only about 1% of our population serve in uniform, that most of our American citizens have no idea what the military does. So this gives some intimate details of what it's like to be a soldier, what it's like to be part of a soldier's family, what it's like to deploy and serve in combat, but also a lot about leadership and how you treat your fellow citizens.
Tremendous. The world today is a much different place than it was in 1990. Since Operation Desert Storm, we've experienced the internet's emergence and social media's rise. Is fostering leadership different today because of that?
Absolutely. I mean, the skill sets are different. I mean, I'll give one example that I talk about in the book. In 1991, there was no such thing as GPS. So we were going across a flat desert, and unless we had some innovative approaches, we didn't know where we were. And in fact, the Iraqis said, how did you come through that desert that way? We don't ever go out there because we get lost. So we had some very innovative young leaders who developed tools to help us do that. Well, now, I mean, I wouldn't get in a car today without an address if I was going someplace strange to plug it in. The intelligence capacity. You know, what we were being fed back in those days was the best kind of information we had at the time. Well, now we have so many sensors and systems to give our military information that, you know, you would think they would never be surprised. But that's not the case because they're surprised by other things. We now have artificial intelligence that can lead us astray. We can have miss and dis and malinformation, the three categories of receiving information about different things that are going on. I just read this morning a case of a West Point cadet that was court-martialed because he extorted a fellow cadet, a female cadet, using AI. And he was court-martialed and thrown out of the military academy because of that case. So these are the kind of things that really require us to relook what our values are, how we have a strong sense of character as individuals, and how we communicate with each other, and at the same time be wary of what is going on in our society that might lead us astray. So to answer your question, I think it's a much different world, requires much greater leaders with a better appreciation of their environment and how they get along with their fellow citizens.
If you could change one thing about how hospitals design and invest in physician leadership programs, what would it be?
Yeah, I think the most important thing is the interprofessional aspect of healthcare, of how do you get the physicians, the administrators, the nurses on the same sheet of music. And then once you get that in a strong approach for an organization, how do you reach out to others? We did an experiment in one of my last classes at Advent Health where we brought a couple of patients in to go through the class with us. So we got the patient's viewpoint of healthcare. And sometimes their viewpoint is radically different than ours. We also brought in a couple of classes when we were dealing with the administrator portion, you immediately think, well, you're going to bring in a campus administrator or a CEO. But we started bringing in the environmental protection services or the budgeteers, the people that do the budget, or the marketing team. And they all had a different concept of what healthcare is all about. And I think the crosstalk with physicians really opened their eyes. It was interesting. There was one vignette I'll share with you where within a class, and I tried to induce debate and discussions in the class. We used the Socratic method. And I'll never forget one class, there was an argument going on about billing. And we had a finance person in the class, and a doctor and this finance officer were going at it. They were really, not understanding each other, where they were each coming from. And finally, the young finance woman said, well, I've never done it that way. And, it's just that I've never seen what you're trying to say. And the doctor responded with, yeah, it's because you've never seen what I'm doing and you don't know how to adjust your financial models to reality of what's going on in the surgical suite or in the hospital room. So it was one of those eye-opening moments where a budgeteer basically said, I've never been in a place where I'm talking to doctors and I don't know your side of the story. So just if you're asking me what would help hospitals, it's just bring people together in that kumbaya moment that gets people looking at things the same way.
Did you find that people were using different metrics for success? It seems like in corporate America, it's much easier because we can look at dollars, right?
Right.
But in the military and in healthcare, it's not always as clear or as obvious what the metrics for success look like. Is that fair?
Yeah, it is. It's not always about, and this was a complaint, another linkage between the military and medicine is I'm not all that concerned about efficiency as I am about effectiveness. And the perfect example in healthcare is RVUs. A doctor has to perform so many engagements with patients on a daily basis. Another vignette, my wife, her mother was living with us for a few years before she died. And we had a geriatric physician we were going to. And my wife made a comment to an administrator at Advent Health about how great this doctor was because she spent time with our mother-in-law and held her hand and really talked her through. And the administrator, probably not realizing what she said, well, that's not the kind of doctor we need. We need doctors pushing patients through and getting more RVUs. So it is that disconnect between business and caring for people.
As our time together draws to a close, I'd like to end on a positive note. In fairness, this has been a very positive discussion, but what gives you hope about the future of physician leadership in this country?
Oh my gosh. Just seeing what they do. I saw it in the military. When I was commanding in Europe, part of our footprint of command was Lonsdale Hospital. And it was, you know, a level two trauma center. They were doing magnificent work because wars were happening in Afghanistan and in Iraq. And they were the transfer point between the combat theaters and Walter Reed and Beaumont and some of the other military hospitals. And I spent as much time as I could up there just learning from how the healthcare professionals did their job. And I'll never forget, or I should say, I'll always remember watching a discussion between a couple of surgeons who were treating a patient with a young, and all three of those surgeons were colonels in the Army, higher rank. And there was a young captain standing nearby just listening to them. But that captain had power because he was the flight surgeon. And he was the one controlling which patients got on his airplane for the flight, the 8-hour flight back to Walter Reed. And he had the yes or no opinion on whether or not the patient would go. So he would listen to the doctors talking about the patient, and he would be the final decision-making authority. I've seen the same thing in civilian systems, where young physicians are admired by older physicians. They have a steady approach to what we should provide in healthcare. The conversations, I think, are continuously improving between doctors and nurses and administrators and getting everyone a seat at the table. And when you see it from the inside, it's just brilliance and magic happening in healthcare. Unfortunately, we sometimes have civilian patients who are depending on Dr. WebMD or something they read on the internet or something they hear a public official say, especially recently, that seem to be contrary to good medical advice. And what I'd say is we've got a professional body of medical professionals who are really out to support the patient, the individuals. And it gives me a great deal of pride to say I had a chance to work with them for a long period of time and still get to work with them today.
My guest has been Lieutenant General Mark Hertling. His new book is If I Don't Return, A Father's Wartime Journal. It's a great read. Mark Hertling, it has been my absolute pleasure and honor to speak with you today. Thank you so much for being on Sound Practice.
It is my pleasure to be with you, and thank you for all you're doing for the American Association of Physician Leadership.
We'll let that be the last word. Thank you, sir.
Okay.
My thanks to Lieutenant General Mark Hertling for his time and thoughts. General Hertling's new book is If I Don't Return, A Father's Wartime Journal. The book is well written and worth your time. My thanks also to the American Association for Physician Leadership for making this podcast possible. Please join me next time on Sound Practice. We release a new episode every other Wednesday.
You've been listening to Sound Practice, the business podcast for physicians and healthcare leaders. Check out the show notes for this episode at soundpractice.com. If you have any suggestions for future episodes, we'd love to hear them. Email us at info@soundpractice.com. Subscribe to Sound Practice wherever you listen to podcasts so you can automatically receive our episodes. And please rate us and comment on the podcast in iTunes and Google Play. Sound Practice is presented and produced by the team at American Association for Physician Leadership. We are the world's premier organization for all aspects of physician leadership in every sector of healthcare. Learn more at physicianleaders.org.
That man Robin, Whitman Kapow.